This is the Improved Photography Podcast, episode number 142. This episode is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way to create a beautiful portfolio website for your photography, a full website, blog, or online store. Squarespace features an elegant interface, beautiful templates, and an incredible 24/7 customer support staff. Try Squarespace at squarespace.com and enter offer code IMPROVE at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace, build it beautiful. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Improved Photography Podcast. I'm your host, Jim Harmer, and today you are joined by thousands and thousands of photographers all around the world, all seeking to defeat boredom as you run on the treadmill, as you commute to work or shop or do whatever it is that you're doing as you listen to the website, as you listen to the podcast and get your weekly dose of photography knowledge. And to talk about today's topics, we have Jeff Harmon and Majid Batizadegan. Hey, guys.
Hey.
Well, Majid has been on the podcast once before. You may remember him from a few episodes ago, but we are working together on a new nature photography podcast that'll be released in a few weeks. So get used to Majid's voice. You're going to be hearing it more and more.
Well, I'm sorry.
Yeah, I know.
As long as I don't have to say his last
just
name.
Just ruined everybody's day. Well, today we're doing an all question and answer episode. We asked on the Improved Photography Podcast Facebook group that you can join. Just search Improved Photography Podcast on Facebook. You're probably a fan of the Improved Photography page already. We have way over 500,000 people on that group, on that page. But this is a group just for the podcast listeners. We don't link to this from anywhere on the website because we don't want spammers. We just want the real podcast listeners on here. So search that Improved Photography Podcast on Facebook and you can connect up with us, and we're communicating a ton on there. Well, Brett Lubke asked the first question. What he wants to do is he wants to make a print and print it on the full face of a door. So it's life size, you know, a 1-to-1 ratio. And then what he wants to do is make it feel like you can step into it. So maybe he's taking a picture of, you know, the beach and he wants it to look like you can kind of step into the beach in the picture. And so he's asking what kind of focal length he would do to make that happen. Well, Brett, I wouldn't use too long of a focal length because that's not how we see. I've never seen anybody's eyeballs that are telephoto. That just doesn't exist, right? And if you do, likewise, don't want to go too wide because that's also not natural. Now, a lot of people would tell you to use a 50 millimeter lens because we call that what's called a normal lens. That's the biggest load of BS I've ever heard, though. I don't know who decided that, because I don't know about you, but I can see a heck of a lot wider than 50 millimeters, a lot wider than 50 millimeters. So where this normal thing came from is absolutely ludicrous. It does nothing to replicate what the eye can see. So my suggestion here would be to go wide, and that's going to help things look normal. However, when you go super, super wide on your focal length, it makes things that are close to the lens seem abnormally large, and things that are medium to far away seem abnormally small. And so what I would do is I would use a very wide angle lens, but I would be kind of careful in your composition that nothing is too close to the camera so that it doesn't seem weirdly large. And so that's what I would do.
How about the difference between crop and full frame there, Jim?
All right. So, in a crop and full frame. So if you're shooting a crop sensor camera, when I say wide angle, I mean like 10 to 14, 15 millimeters. If we're shooting on a full frame camera, I'm talking about 14 to 18 millimeters, somewhere in there. So the crop factor is going to make this seem a little bit more telephoto. So that's what I'm talking about when I'm saying wide. That's what I mean by wide.
All right, very good. So next question was from Tony Perea, and he's asking if it makes a difference between on a full frame versus a crop, not only on the focal length, which we just talked about, that they're different on between full frame and crop, but f-stop, the aperture. And probably what he's really referring to is the depth of field. Saw a video that said there is a difference there, and you have to account for that in the depth of field. And that is absolutely true. The depth of field, the same lens on the crop versus full frame, the depth of field is going to be different. So you have to factor that into if you want to try to get the same depth of field on a crop that you do in full frame, you have to have a different focal length or a different aperture. You have to go either more fast on the fast side, go down, go. The ratios are different, so I always screw this up. but you have to go to a lower number or open up the aperture more if you want the shallower depth of field than you would on full frame. And then the reverse is true, and kind of an advantage in some landscape kind of photography where if you are stopping down the aperture, it's a bigger number, then there's going to be lots more in focus than on the crop than on the full frame.
Yeah. So
that can be an advantage for landscape.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the trick here is this. So let's say we put an 85 millimeter lens, since that's a common one, right? Let's say we put an 85 millimeter lens on a crop sensor camera and the same 85 millimeter lens on a full frame camera. Which one has the shallower depth of field? Ah, well, this is tricky because if they're both shooting at f2.8, well, you would say that the full frame camera is going to have shallower depth of field. Why? Because, well, it's a full frame camera and that produces shallower depth of field. However, the crop sensor camera, that 85 millimeter lens is now a, whatever it is, 115 right, or something. And a longer focal length also reduces the depth of field. And so I don't know. I'd have to run the numbers on which one would do better. And it would depend on how far we are from the subject. There are going to be some other variables in there. But it's going to be somewhat close to sixes here. I mean, it's not going to make such a big difference because the focal length changed. So there are differences with both. And you have to learn how to speak focal length a little bit here. I just posted an article on improvephotography.com that explains focal length as simply as possible. Now, focal length is a really simple concept, but seriously, go read that article. I'll bet 90% of you are going to learn something new that you maybe didn't quite realize about focal length in there. So check it out and go to improvephotography.com and just search focal length, or just look on the homepage if you're watching this right when the episode's released, and you'll see something about it there. The article's just called focal length. So there's a lot to it there, but those are some of the factors you'd look at.
I also have a photo taco episode on it, so people can go find that.
Perfect.
There's one dedicated to focal length.
Awesome. So Gordon Jackson asked, basically, when you get all these bracketed shots when you're shooting landscape, what do you do to organize them? So if you come back and you've really only shot like 3 or 4 compositions, but you have 500 pictures because you've stacked exposures, you're shooting straight into the sun or whatever. If anybody's ever done that before, or you know that Lightroom can really fill up and it can be confusing where one picture starts, if you adjusted your composition a little bit or that type of thing, it can be confusing. So he's asking basically, how do you manage that the best? And there's a feature within Lightroom where you can stack your bracketed shots automatically. So you can auto stack by capture time, and you choose basically the time between exposures. And this is going to read the exif of the file and automatically group those images into stacks. If you don't go the automated way through Lightroom, you can also manually group your photos into stacks as well.
Very good. That should help a lot. Tice Van Gennep says, it's almost autumn. We have a lot of mushrooms outside. What tips do you have for photographing mushrooms? I don't know.
I have never tried to photograph mushrooms.
Yeah, I don't know that I have any like specific mushroom photography tips, but I can point you at least in the right direction of taking pictures of macro subjects in nature. And the best thing that you can do is bring a reflector around with you so that you can cover the area that you're going to shoot with the macro shot so you don't get the nasty hard light outside. The other thing is, don't just shoot down on the mushrooms or flowers or whatever it is that you're shooting. Put that camera, smash it flat on the ground. In fact, sometimes I will just use my hand and just kind of dig up some of the dirt beside the flower or the mushroom Not that I've ever shot mushrooms, beside the flower that I've shot, so that I can get my camera even lower and shooting more up at the flower for those really low flowers to the ground. It's really helpful if you have an articulating LCD screen for something like this. So I guess just a couple ideas to point you in the right direction. But I don't know if there's like mushroom photography tips.
Okay. And Katie Shipley, she wants to know if we'd recommend taking small soft boxes on stands for outdoor portrait shoots. And I suppose that could work, but I just had an experience this last weekend. We went and did some family portraits. We met in a canyon here in Utah, and great fall colors starting to come out. The natural light, it was great. We met near sunset because I wanted to just have the natural light. And I saw there was another photographer there, and he had soft boxes set up. He had two of them. He had this family sitting out on the river, and I'm sure they got a really good shot, and that's it. They didn't get anything else. These kids were playing in the river. He could have had these awesome candid shots.
He had too much gear set up so he couldn't move around and shoot.
He was gear ridden so that it was like immobilizing. He couldn't do anything else, you know? And so I'm sure he got a fantastic shot of the family next to the river. I'm sure that's there. He probably looks beautiful, but that's probably the only shot he got because there's so much gear. He wasn't mobile enough to move around with this family and take pictures. Whereas I took probably, I don't know, 1500 pictures. We'll throw a bunch of them away, but it's kids that were throwing rocks in the river, and we have all these candid shots. They're interacting with the parents. So I don't know. What do you think, Jim? Soft boxes? I know the monopod with the flashes on the end is something that probably would be mobile enough and helpful.
Yeah, that's what I would recommend. I just skip the light stand. You know, great. Use a soft box if you want to. I wouldn't use a soft box, one single soft box for a family usually. It's just too directional of a light source. I would use an umbrella. But, you know, a soft box is great. I use them all the time, but I would put it on the end of a monopod, way better. Go to improvephotography.com and just click on the little search button at the top right and type light stick. That's what we call it, a light stick, where you just have a monopod with a flash on the end. And I'll show you the pieces you need. It's really inexpensive to make a light stick. And it's so much easier to just hold it up on the end of a monopod than hauling around light stands and stuff. And you're right, with kids playing by the river, and you know, you want to be able to move around and shoot. And when you have light stands and crud set up everywhere, that's really hard to do.
The other thing that was really helpful was I had a massive diffuser, so I could take off the harsh light that was, because we were there a couple of hours before sunset. So at the very beginning, there was some harsh lighting and big shadows, and just put that diffuser in front of them. And we got some great lights, even shooting the flash through the diffuser. That really made a nice soft light. And that thing is super portable. That was really easy.
Very cool.
I don't know about you guys, but those candid moments are sometimes the best moments.
Oh, yeah. And I've had lots of families come back and say, my favorites are the ones I didn't even know you took.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So Josh Feining asks basically for some general tips on shooting super wide. And as primarily a landscape photographer, I am always shooting wide angle, or often 95% of the time shooting wide angle. My tips would be one thing that always happens or often happens when you're new to shooting wide is you don't pay a lot of attention to the background and you let it get too small. So this huge grand mountain or this beautiful waterfall is now a tiny, tiny speck in the distance, and it's inconsequential to your frame. So building off of that, you know, you don't always have to be at 10 or 11 millimeters on crop or 14 or 15 millimeters on full frame. You can, you know, as long as it's not a prime, if it's a zoom, you zoom in a little bit. So there's not as much of a disparity in the size of the visual objects in the frame. Second, find an interesting foreground. If you're going to shoot really, really wide, then get something interesting close to the camera, because what a wide angle lens or super wide angle focal length is doing is it's exaggerating what's near the front of the lens, and it's minimizing or making whatever is far away much smaller. And finally, most important thing, fill the visual space. Composition rules still apply, so keep that in mind. You know, the same rules of composition are still your friend in that case.
Very good. Katil Antonios Augustsson from Iceland. I love Iceland. In fact, I was just thinking before we recorded this podcast, gosh, I've got to go back. I just have to go back. There's so much more world to see yet, but I've got to go back to Iceland. He asks for us to explain a little bit about online backup and some of the services that we have tried. Well, I would start here. What you want is a 3-to-1 backup. You want 3 copies of your data and on 2 different types of media, and one of them has to be off-site. That means not in the same house as your regular data is. Now, the 2 different types of data ideally would be something like one on microfiche and one on hard drives. That's not going to happen. Nobody's going to do that, right? And so we're going to kind of cheat a little bit on that one and just say one is on, you know, your internal hard drive, one's in a RAID, one's in the cloud, something like that, just that it's a little bit different. And by having that, you're pretty well safe. So we're talking about mostly the off-site piece right here. And to get your data off-site, if you have a small amount of data, you have not that many photos to worry about, I would start with Carbonite. If your photos fit on your internal hard drive, I've found nothing better than Carbonite for doing this quickly, inexpensively, and making it actually get the photos up to the server. But you're gonna outgrow Carbonite, and you're gonna outgrow it pretty quickly. Why? Because unless you go to one of the more advanced and more expensive plans, Carbonite isn't gonna back up anything that's not on your actual hard drive. RAID is not gonna work for you. So then we're going to have to graduate. And when we graduate, when our photos no longer fit on the internal hard drive and we're trying to do a cloud backup, just know that this may or may not be possible. For me, it's not possible. I've tried a whole number of different services. And the problem is I shoot more photos than it can upload. And so, you know, it'll be uploading and it'll be at the pace of maybe it can get 500 gigabytes that'll allow me to get up during the week. Well, maybe I'm shooting more than that, you know, because I'll go on one trip and I have hours and hours of video and thousands of photos and stuff, and I outpace it. So for me, I've never found an online backup that will work. And that's for 2 reasons. One is it's limited by your ISP, that it may be really super fast for the first few days and you're like, yeah, I'm going to get an online backup. And then it slows down and slows down. And by the end of 2 weeks, your ISP just says, meh, we're done with this online backup thing. You're using too much bandwidth. And you'll see that you're uploading like 20 kilobytes an hour. Your ISP just murders it, right? And then the other limitation here is the backup service itself will put a clincher on it as well. They'll say, you're using too much hard drive here. Let's put the stop to this. So one or the other often always ends up being the limitation for me. I can't back up online. It just doesn't work. So I've just got to have, I just have 2 RAID devices with my data. Right now, that's the best I can do. Maybe Google Fiber will move into my neighborhood and eventually I can do that. But right now, it just can't happen for me. But some of the services you can try out are, one is Amazon Prime. If you have an Amazon Prime account, you can do this for free. The problem with Amazon Prime is that it does not have... It does not have a tool to automatically sync your files. You have to like take the pictures and remember to move them over into Amazon Prime. That's a major limitation. And also you can try Backblaze and Mozy and other things like that. Jeff, you deal with this all the time. What kind of feedback do you have on this?
Yeah, I did Carbonite for 2 years, never got a backup done.
Oh, really? I had such good luck with them.
They throttled it like crazy. It was their side because I switched to Backblaze and in 8 months I got my 3 terabyte library back. So at least it finished.
8 months, you know? But it finished.
Yeah.
But you're not outpacing it?
Not currently, no. I'm being a hobbyist photographer. I don't shoot enough for it to get super far behind.
That's great. So hey, yeah, try them, but do know that at some point it may not be possible. And yeah, I've used the internet in Iceland, not that good. Let me just say, not that good.
I have an article at improvephotography.com about storage workflow that has a ton of information about all of this. So go check that out too.
And a word of caution too, is these sites don't always stay in business. It costs a lot of money to run a business of storing terabytes and exabytes of data, whatever. And if a business runs out of money, you may get an email saying, hey, you have 14 days to download all your stuff and we're closing our doors. And then everyone's going to run. And, you know, it's the nightmare scenario where the server's at full load and you're trying to get off your most treasured memories because that's your only copy. Look into the local backup options first.
It's like having a run on the bank.
Exactly.
All right, Jeff, I'm thinking you have some input on Dennis Helmer's question about looking for a Windows 10 update and if it's a good idea to use on your main product, on your main production machine.
Yep. You know, I give updates every couple of weeks about where it's at. I still recommend photographers wait. Don't upgrade your main editing PC to Windows 10 yet, even though it's free, even though it's been out since July. My sense of it is they rushed and rushed and rushed. The marketing guys got in one room and met and said, boy, July 29th would be a great day to release Windows 10. And the engineers were in a different room saying, there's no way we're going to meet July 29th for Windows 10. And the two worked together to try to get it, you know, the best they could out there, but it wasn't fully baked. It wasn't quite ready. There's issues, especially related to Photoshop and Lightroom that have been out there. But even some of their own apps, their own mail app, for example, has been really causing lots of trouble for lots of users. And some of their other apps, it's just not quite there. I have it on four different PCs in my house and they're fine, but they're not trying to do Photoshop and Lightroom. They're not trying to do anything upscale. They run a browser and maybe Word, and that's it. They're not power users, power machines. So if you weren't doing it on your main PC, I think it's ready. It's fine. But not yet for the main one. There's a release coming sometime before the end of the year called the Threshold 2 release. And I'm thinking that's what the engineers were originally targeting was this Threshold 2 release. And the marketing team got their way and got one out there on July 29th. But this next release, I expect a lot of polish and finish on the OS to make it far more ready for use. And so we'll see once that comes, if that's when my recommendation will change. But for now, I'd say wait. And that's why you don't see the review out there, because my recommendation is to wait.
Hold the lines. All right. We have lots more questions to get to. But before we do that, we want to take a second and thank two companies that have supported Improved Photography in making this podcast possible. The first is Squarespace. You all know that I love Squarespace. I've been using Squarespace since before they were even a sponsor of Improved Photography. I like Squarespace because it's inexpensive. It's so easy to get set up, and it does everything that I need a photography portfolio site to do. The designs are beautiful. It shows the pictures big. Whenever I want to just change the design of my website, it would be so long on the way that I was doing my website before this, but we're really just a couple clicks away, and you have a totally new, fresh design for your website. And I don't have to work on resizing every picture that I upload. It does it all for me. It makes it mobile friendly, looks great on an iPad, great on a computer. You can add a full blog to it if you want to blog about the things you're doing in photography. There's even an online store all built into Squarespace so that you're not limited in what you want to do with your photography site or any other business site that you do. So you can get started with Squarespace for just $8 a month. You've been hearing us talking about Squarespace for a long time. They're one of our favorite companies that support Improved Photography. Go check them out this week. If you haven't tried it out, seriously, at least go give it a shot. Go to squarespace.com. Use offer code IMPROVE, and that'll get you 10% off your first purchase, and it's already pretty inexpensive. Put together a photography portfolio. It's something that Jeff Harmon's been talking about for a long time. Get those 20 best photos that you have of the year and put them together on a website. Share it on your personal Facebook. Go share your Squarespace site on the Improved Photography Podcast Facebook group, and let's see the things that you're building there. It's an excellent resource for photographers or anybody that needs a website. So go to squarespace.com and enter offer code IMPROVE to get 10% off off your first purchase. Squarespace, build it beautiful. And by Harry's. When I go and travel with the Improved Photography Travel Group, I always have to budget in an extra $50 for every trip. Why? Because I always end up leaving my razor in the hotel bathroom. So Harry's has come to the solution. They make razors that don't cost an arm and a leg. It's about half the cost of what a typical razor is, and the blades are better. They're made in Germans, and we happen to know that German engineers make some pretty good stuff. So you can get a, you know, instead of paying $32 every time you want another 8 blades, you can get it for about half the cost, and you're getting a better quality blade anyway. For $15, you can get a razor, moisturizing shave cream, and 3 razor blades by using promo code IMPROVE, and you get 5% off your first purchase. So check it out at harrys.com. And use offer code IMPROVE to get $5 off your first purchase. And we really thank Harry's for supporting Improved Photography and all the things that we do. All right, we have a lot of other questions from listeners of Improved Photography. The first is Katie Shipley. Katie asks, I've read that shutter speed should double what the focal length of the lens is to make sure that we don't get any camera shake. How do I know what this is if I'm using a zoom lens? So this is a new thing to me because I thought kind of everybody knew this, but when I was writing that focal length article, I searched on the Q&A section of Improved Photography, and a ton of people have asked about this. And I think a lot of people just haven't noticed. Right on the barrel of your lens, right where it connects to the camera, every lens that I think I've ever seen has a little focal length scale right there. So as you twist the lens to zoom in, it will show you right there what specific focal length you're on. And so, you know, if you have an 18 to 55 millimeter lens and you're somewhere in the middle, you've zoomed in, just check that scale and you'll see right there what your focal length is. But you know what? I don't think we need to be kind of, you know, focal length Pharisees here. I think we can take this a little bit too far in like, oh boy, I'm at 17 millimeters and I just shot this at 1/30th of a second, not quite double, right? Like, it's just an idea. It's just giving you a general place to be with your focal length. There are so many exceptions to this rule, but it gives you a general idea. But again, I don't know if we would need to panic about this one.
Sensor size matters.
Yeah, it totally does. Sensor size is going to impact it. And if I'm using a 600 millimeter lens, I don't have to be at 1/1200th of a second. I'm going to feel just fine at 1/500th of a second. You know, it works to a point, and then the rule kind of starts to fall apart.
But I was going to say, if it's a zoom lens, so that you don't have to worry about it while you're shooting, you don't want to be looking at what zoom you're at while you're shooting, just use the end of it, the max focal length. What's the biggest number the lens could go to? Roughly double it as a starting point until you get to know your camera and lens combination, so you know what speed you have to have it at in different lighting conditions, because that'll play a big role too.
And it also depends if the lens has image stabilization,
right?
And how steady you can hold it. Yeah.
Yeah. If you're holding the camera steady, your technique is really important. So there's a lot of variables that go into what produces a sharp photograph, but kind of that double rule is kind of a fail safe or as close to fail safe as you can get for handheld shooting.
Yeah, if you're doubling the focal length, it's almost always going to be fine as long as you have reasonable technique. But I think what we're saying in all these examples is sometimes you can really cheat lower than that and you're just fine. All right, David Davis says, could all of the hosts please let us know your biggest photographic influence, who it has been, and some of the things that they've done. So who are some of the people that influence you guys in photography?
I can do this one. There's an artist who has absolutely just been killing it lately, and he is just a machine. His name is Michael Sheenbloom. I think he's out of the Bay Area. Anytime he comes up to Oregon, I meet up with him when I get the chance. But this guy is 20-something-year-old, and he posts the most technically sound and amazing shots of the night sky that you'll ever see. And he's a perfectionist. You can see it in his work. It's very technically sound. He's very inspiring photographer for me.
Cool. One that I love that we've had as a guest on the podcast before is Ryan Dyer. I just love the lighting in his landscapes. It's something that I have really been working on over the last couple of years, and he just nails it. He just does a beautiful job at making sure every landscape not just has good color in the sky, but also has good like a super punchy, contrasty light in the sky on all of his photos. And I just really, really like that look.
So, you know, mine are kind of some Instagram people.
Cool.
I'm finding a lot of inspiration from there. So I don't know them at all. I don't even know their real names. That's just their Instagram handles. There is one whose handle is Jude Allen. I think that's his name. I was looking real quick here. Yeah, Jude Allen. I'm not even sure where he's from. He posts pictures from all over the country. So I don't know what the story is on him much. I presume his name is Jude, but I don't know. And I really like his stuff a lot. And then, of course, Jim.
Yeah. Right. All right. Thank you, everybody, for your questions. We have just a few more here. One is from Alan Pawani. He asks if anybody is using Photo Mechanic. He says, I use a Fuji camera, so I have to use an external RAW editor. Now, that's the part that I'm a little bit confused on there, Alan. Just because you use a Fuji camera doesn't mean you can't just use Lightroom. You don't have to use an external RAW editor to use Lightroom. I'm wondering if maybe you got something like a Fuji X-T10 or something that just didn't have the camera profile uploaded in Lightroom. Anytime you get a brand new camera, as soon as it's announced, Canon, Nikon, whatever, it takes Adobe a few weeks to get those profiles loaded up into Lightroom. But there's no reason you couldn't use a Fuji camera with Lightroom. I do it every single day. But in regard to your question, Photo Mechanic, I've never tried it. I've heard tons of reviews from different people. Generally, the things that I hear are it's very fast, but the editor is extremely basic. And you've got to switch over your total cataloging system if you're getting out of Lightroom. And for me, that is the killer. You can kind of cobble this together, but it's a mess when you have two photo organizing programs. They fight each other.
Yeah, that's exactly how I've heard it used. Is that people they'll take the images off the SD card, put it in on their computer, run through it with Photo Mechanic just to do the culling of them. Yeah. And then they go into Lightroom.
Yeah, that's a pain. But it looks great for speed.
So Robin Gaspar asks basically how to soft-proof in Lightroom or Photoshop for brightness and darkness. And she said that she's printed photos before that looked awesome on screen, but then printed out too dark.
Yeah, it's always how it goes too.
And that is how it goes. And guess why? Because when you're looking at a computer screen, you're staring at kind of a light bulb. And when you look at a piece of paper, you're looking at a piece of paper with ink on it. It's not backlit by a light bulb. So that whole translation process, what you see on those pixels to what you see in print, there is some adjustments and some things that you need to do to prepare your file. First of all, calibrate your monitor. Make sure you're calibrated. Second, when you're working on your photos, make sure the light that you're working in is a controlled environment. So if you have a few windows in your room and you go and edit a photo in the morning and then you come back and you look at it and it's completely different at night, well, it's probably because the light has changed. So blackout curtains can help, or just having some sort of controlled light, just like they did in the olden days with film. You know, they controlled the light. It was a dark room. Now today, we have the digital dark room. And she said she wants to order a canvas, but she's afraid it'll be too dark. A lot of the labs that are going to take your photos that are in the sRGB color space, they're going to make some of these adjustments automatically as they go to print, because they know that the sRGB files are going to be on the darker end. Really, to control the print process from start to finish, you need to print through a pro lab where there's no human interaction between you and what's coming out of the printer. So there's no lab tech that is heavy-handed that's going to make an adjustment to your white balance or make an adjustment to your brightness. Not saying that always happens, but you can take that factor out by printing directly to a pro lab.
There you go. Justin Zafaris asks, is it worth using a Canon L series 70-200 2.8 on a Nikon body with an adapter? Justin, stop the madness. Stop the madness. All right. Now, so I gotcha. I'm following the train of thought. Okay, here's the train of thought. I can read your mind, Justin. Canon L series 70-200 regarded slightly better than the Nikon. Use adapter and put it on Nikon, right? Then you get the beautiful Nikon D800 that there's nothing better with the nothing better Canon 70-200. Well, it doesn't quite work that way. See, the adapter is not a panacea for a lens, for switching to a lens system, right? It's not that it just solves all the problems. In fact, it adds a whole new slew of problems when you put an adapter to a different camera's lens system. You can lose some light. It's changing the sharpness, right? Because you're putting stuff between the lens and the body. And so it's going to change all of the engineering of that lens. And now we're doing our best to minimize that, but it is changing it. And the biggest change is focus speed. Those lenses and cameras are so tuned and fine-tuned to get that focus to happen lightning speed. But when we adapt it, it's a totally different company's technology and connections and everything, and we're trying to make it work. Now, some cameras do this exceptionally well. I've heard very good reviews about putting L glass on the A7R Mark II. Most cameras don't, are just not going to work with this. You are going to be so much happier. Just go get the Nikon 70-200 2.8. Personally, for me, I prefer the Nikon to the Canon 70-200. In terms of optical quality, I mean, they are so close to the same. Well, let's just call it the same thing. But I like the Nikon because that tripod collar is a little bit taller. And that means that it's a lot more comfortable to hold. Because to me, the optical quality is so close that, like, what difference is it really going to make? And so I'll just go for the comfort.
Very good. All right. Lizzie Mitchell, she's asking a question. I'm not sure I can explain exactly, but let's go through it. It says, or she wanted to know, she's been shooting with a Canon Rebel T5, not a T5i, and I think that might be the key, and a kit lens, 55 to 250 kit lens. And when she takes pictures of people, she's seeing color noise in their faces. She's saying she can't believe it's really because of ISO, because she's shooting under 400 ISO usually. And I think the answer here is, unfortunately, I think it's the camera body and the sensor inside it. That the Rebel series, there's a huge difference between the T5 and the T5i. And I mean, serious difference in the sensor. Really, really big difference. So even at ISO 400 with the T5, the sensor in that camera, it's just not great. It would have been better to spend another $100 or whatever the price difference was to get the I version. And I think you'd have been a lot happier with the results. So I think if you're really getting noise at that ISO, unfortunately, there's probably not a lot you can do. It's a limitation of your camera.
Okay. Michelle Nolan is asking for some advice on some non-photographic things. She says, one, she's looking for some knee pads for her landscape photography. Now, I think this is a great question. I use knee pads when I go shoot landscapes. I felt a little bit dorky the very first time that I did it. But after you get over that, much more comfortable. And I get better photos, especially when it's cold outside and you know you're going to freeze yourself if you kneel down on the ground. It kind of allows you to get down and get those better photos. Now, the way that I do it is I bought some tactical pants. These are for, you know, military, for police, that kind of thing. Just search tactical pants on Amazon. And then a lot of them have just a little insert knee pad. So you don't even really notice it when you're walking around. They look like regular kind of khaki pants, but then they have a knee pad in it. I really like wearing those when I'm shooting landscapes or when I'm shooting sports photography and I'm going to want to be getting down. A hat? I don't know. I like an Under Armour hat. I don't know if it really matters. Shoes, you know, I like getting waterproof boots when I'm shooting landscape photography so that I can get out there if it's really wet, if there's dew on the ground, if it's ice, snow, whatever, I can kind of go through everything. The problem with getting waterproof boots for doing landscape photography is they don't breathe as well, and so they end up stinking pretty soon. I have to throw away my boots, not because they're worn coming out, but because they kind of start to stink because they just don't breathe as you're walking around. TMI for a photography podcast? Probably. let's get just a couple more questions in here before we end.
All right, Vince Yamashiroya. Oh boy, sorry, Vince. he's asking a bunch of questions here in his post, but let's focus on the sharing a Lightroom library between a laptop and a desktop. So he's kind of asking about what's a good way to do that. And there isn't a great way to do that, unfortunately. It just doesn't work all that well. So there's lots of ways to try to make the function work. You can use, I think last week you talked about, Jim, that you can use XMP files, and that will then anytime you make a change, it's written right next to the photo.
Yeah.
So if you edit it on a laptop and then you move all the files and the XMP files over to a desktop, when you load them up in a Lightroom, then it sees all those changes, and that's one way to kind of handle it. But boy, it's, you know, that's still not transparent. There's still some work there. You can try using a RAID system too, like a network-based storage solution where you can have the laptop and the desktop both pointing to the same library files and XMP files to make that work. But the way that these programs are written today, they're not made to really work like that. That it takes some special programming to make it so that you can have two things trying to access the same file system at the same time and not right over the top of each other. Mm-hmm. And they're not written this way. So there's not a great way to do this to make it so that you can use it between the two. It really kind of needs to be, you do it on one and then you switch to the other, not at the same time. You can do like the XMP files, like we said, although I think there's some bad performance problems with that in CC and Lightroom 6.
Yeah.
And then
Lightroom 6 has performance problems just period, no matter what you do. I've tried just switching around every which configuration and maybe some things are making a little, no, it's just bad. It's just all there is to it. I think that your best bet here is go with the all right changes to XMP and then make sure you have a home-based computer. One computer that this is home base and everything I do on the laptop is really temporary and I'm going to transfer this over. It's not beautiful. It is clunky, but eventually you're going to get into a rhythm and I think that's the best you can do right now.
And I don't know what the difference is because I'm not really, myself, I'm not seeing lots of performance problems in Lightroom. So mine's doing great.
You're about the only one. I want your Lightroom because everybody I talk to that's in Lightroom and including myself, I know Nick and Darren and everybody I talk to is just ready to rip their own eyeballs out when they're trying to use Lightroom. It's driving me nuts.
Yeah, I don't know what the difference is. I'm not having any trouble.
Margot Winter Smith says, is it safe to go to Lightroom CC yet? Have all the bugs in Lightroom 6 been worked out? Well, no, they have not. But I would say yes, go to Lightroom CC. I don't know if this is going to get better. And I keep getting questions on this, you know, you keep saying on the podcast that we're having a lot of problems in Lightroom. Is it safe to go? I don't know. Maybe if you're really happy with your Lightroom, you know, that's fine. Stick with it. I don't know that there's a compelling gotta have it reason to get into Lightroom CC yet. But I don't know. This has been going on for a while. This could just be as it is. So I think if you're, you know, don't let this hold back your photography. If you're wondering like, you know, should I buy Lightroom? Yes, go buy it yesterday. There are some bugs in it, but it's still the best we got right now. And so go get it. You know, it may not be perfect, but I still could never even dream of getting rid of it. So yes, I would say go get it yesterday. It's great. All right. We answered a ton of questions, but we didn't even make a dent. We have so many more from our listeners. So maybe we're going to have to do FAQ part 3 next week. Thank you everybody for joining us on this episode of the Improved Photography Podcast. And we'll be back next week to destroy your questions and save your photography. Until then, we'll see you in another 7 days.